Every weekend, it's the Moore of Pittsburgh. Chris Moore. The Chris Moore Show. News Radio 1020, KDKA.
KDK Radio News Time 4:06. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the program. It's Chris Moore, the Moore of Pittsburgh, on the air with you until 9 o'clock tonight. Here's a rundown of some of the things that we are going to be talking about. In our 6 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to one of the members of Occupy Pittsburgh, Mike Lawson. He's out there at the encampment right now. We'll see what's going on in Pittsburgh and indeed around the nation. In our 5 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to Jeffrey M. Smith. He's the author of the number one GMO bestseller, Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette. He'll tell us all about Monsanto and Terminator seeds and what he thinks that they are doing with GMO or genetically modified organisms when it comes to growing our food. And speaking of food, we're going to talk about food in the first hour, too, with Joel Satterlund. He's the owner of Polyface Farms. He has authored about 8 books on the subject of farming, including his latest, Folks, This Ain't Normal. And he's been featured in Time just this past week with an article where they say he's a self-described libertarian Christian lunatic farmer. Joel, welcome to Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thank you.
All right. You sound like my kind of guy already. So where's the food?
Where's the food?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's supposed to be in your home larder, but most of the time the food is in a Costco warehouse 1,500 miles away.
And the problem that we should have with that, but obviously don't, is what?
Well, just from a sheer matter of security and energy use, you know, in food that you can't see or put your hands on obviously is not very close. And the farther away it is, the more chance it has to go bad, to take a lot of energy to get to you, to be disrupted in some, you know, upheaval, whether it's a Teamster strike or a bioterrorist threat or whatever. And so, you know, historically, we have always had our food nearby. And that's where the term larder came from. And today, you know, the average city only has 3 days worth of food in it. So we're, you know, we're all just 72 hours away from, you know, from serious problems. If we had a problem,
you know, we see it here in Pittsburgh all the time. Every time it snows 4 or 5 inches, you can't get a loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, or even toilet paper, to tell you the truth. And that's indicates what you're talking about in terms of the food chain. But can the local product market, farmers, provide everything we need to eat?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, it's the only thing that really can create a secure food system. America has 35 million acres of lawn and 36 million acres housing and feeding recreational horses. That's 71 million acres, and I haven't even counted the medians of the interstates or the clover leaves or the, you know, the other spots, just what we call the edges. That is enough to feed the entire country without a single farm. Yes, there is plenty of land and plenty of availability to do this. It just hasn't been done. We have extricated ourselves from a visceral relationship with our food, with production, and you know, most people are way more interested and knowledgeable about the latest belly button piercing in Hollywood than they are what's going to become flesh of their flesh and bone of their bones at 5 o'clock this evening.
You know, I think that's an interesting take on it. I think of my father-in-law as a gentleman country small farmer, no more than 12 head of cattle, one or two hogs. I remember the first time he saw one of those big hog production facilities where all these white animals were standing in there shoulder to shoulder in their own manure. He said it was the most devilish thing he had ever seen. How far have we gotten away from the kind of production we used to do, and can we get back to it? I guess, what do you call normal anymore?
Well, there's a lot of definitions for normal, but since you brought up hog confinement animal facilities, let's look at pigs just to give you a flavor, no pun intended, of some of my thinking for what normal is. What was a hog's function throughout history. You know, the Creator designed the pig, or if it evolved, or however you want to look at that, the pig has a plow on the end of its nose. It's an omnivore. And so historically, pigs have been used as salvage operations for acorns, chestnuts, whey in cheese making, soured milk, you know, spoiled vegetables, whatever.
They'll eat anything, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. In other words, they were used. You know, George Washington had them there at Mount Vernon and running in the woods. So did Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. I mean, this was the backbone of the pork, you know, business for years. They fed on. They were a salvage operation for perennial nuts, fruits, and soured or waste products from the farmstead. Now, what happens is when you stop that historic use, so what happens today is that roughly 100%, here's the statistic, 50% of all the human edible food produced in the world never gets eaten by humans. It either rots, or it spoils, or it, you know, it exceeds the sell-by date, or it's improper portion, or mislabeled, or whatever. But the point is that half of the world's food. Now, historically, that food would go to pigs, stuff that was blemished or was, you know, had to be salvaged. Today, that food goes into landfills, and the landfills get over full, and we put big blimp diaphragms over the landfill, stick tubes out down in them, pull off the methane, and call that green, green infrastructure. Real green infrastructure would be to hook pigs or chickens into their embedded normal station, so they don't have to eat all of the grain that's eroding the Midwest and the soils from Iowa and Ohio and Indiana, and using up the groundwater in the Ogallala Aquifer. Instead, salvaging the forest droppings and the wasted food, and utilizing that for local consumption. I mean, around here, we've got, good grief, we've got the George Washington National Forest. We've got enough acorns in the state of, you know, Virginia here in Appalachia to grow all the pigs that we need without any corn or beans or any annual.
You know, I've read that a cow eats a heck of a lot of corn in the last month of its life on a feedlot, again, standing in his own manure, perhaps. And we could feed the whole world, to tell you the truth, when it came to the what we feed animals like cows in the last month of their life.
Absolutely. And again, when you talk about historical normalcy, the reason that we didn't feed herbivores grain historically was because grain was extremely expensive. You know, in the days before cheap energy and relatively cheap machinery, tillage was extremely difficult. That's why the main nutrient-dense ingredient of all cultures throughout history have either been seafood or herbivores, whether it's yaks, alpacas, bison, cows, sheep, goats, llamas, and milk. From those herbivores, those mammalian herbivores. The reason is because until extremely recent days, all tillage was difficult. I mean, if in order to plant a corn plant or a barley plant, you know, you had to walk behind a yoke of oxen for a day with a stick to stir the ground, then you had to, you know, spread it with your hand, then you had to hoe it with your hand hoe.
You weren't going to waste that feeding a farm animal, in other words.
I mean, that's why, you know, it's Sunday. I hope it's all right to invoke the Bible. You know, in the biblical book of Hosea, the prophet talks about a harlot being worth 9.5 ephahs of barley. It's not because barley, it's not because harlots were cheap. It's because barley was expensive.
Boy, all right, hold that thought right there. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Joel Satlin, the owner of Polyface Farms. We're going to ask him about some of his farming methods and how we might adopt them across the nation to improve the food that we eat. KDK Radio News Time 418. Joel Satlin is, I guess, the owner of Polyface Farms. Joel, your family's been in the farming business for generations, so I guess you didn't have any epiphany about this. These things have been kind of handed down to you about the way things used to be done, the way things have changed, and the way you try to do them. I often say that I think everybody around here would be a vegetarian if they had to get their meat from the way we used to produce meat. Nobody's been at a hog killing that I know of around this time of year in a long time. I just don't think that, you know, if you didn't go to the grocery store and find it wrapped up in cellophane, we would be eating much meat, to tell you the truth.
Well, I mean, people used to eat a tremendous amount of meat, primarily because it was so nutrient dense. In a day when transportation was so difficult, because of draft power, or you had to go and dig some coal or chop some wood to get some energy. In those days, nobody was able to especially transport watery stuff like vegetables and lettuce and things like that. And I mean, it's 95% water. You just can't be trucking mescaline mix and lettuce and cabbage that's mainly water. You just can't be trucking that 1,500 miles, which is the average that every morsel of food in America travels today.
Wow.
So are you saying that most people wouldn't eat meat just because they don't want to be involved with the processing?
Yeah, the processing of it, the kind of stuff where you get your hands on a hog and hit him in the head or shoot him in the head with a .22, you boil the water, you do all that kind of stuff. I think a whole lot of people go, ugh, if they came in and saw a squirrel all dressed out sitting on the dining room table, or a rabbit or anything like that. I really do. But what I want you to talk about, though, is your methods of farming over the generations at Polyface.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about that and what you think is a better method of farming and eating local foods.
Sure. Well, here at our farm, what's different about us is that everything's on pasture rather than confining animals in a confinement animal feeding operation. They're on pasture, which means the infrastructure, the shelters and things are all portable. They're either on wheels or skids or whatever, and some of these are pretty big. I mean, 1,000 square feet or larger, and we move them every day to mimic the kind of movement that you see in nature in animals. Whether any kind of an animal in nature, they're always moving from place to place, migrating or moving with predation, whether it's two-legged or four-legged predation. And so mimicking that, we use real high-tech electric fencing and computer microchip electric fence energizers, lightweight infrastructure to mimic this movement pattern that we see, whether it's the wildebeest on the Serengeti or the way the bison moved on the American plain.
What does that do for the animal and the land?
Well, great question. What it does is, obviously, it gets the animal moved away from yesterday's toilet area. These animals don't wear diapers. And so by moving them away from yesterday's toilet area, it keeps the animals much more sanitary and hygienic, which is, lower pathogenicity, better, more health. But secondly, it allows you to do a very short-term disturbance on a piece of land, and then go to a long rest period before something comes back. And it's that pattern of disturbance and rest that exercises the ecology to a higher successional plane of germinational diversity. Those are a lot of big words there, but essentially what it means is, look, let's make an easy picture. If you want to plant a garden, you don't just go out in your lawn and throw some carrot seeds out and say, now I've got a garden. You're going to have to take a shovel or a spade. You're going to have to do some disturbance in order to create a germination bed that allows you to move the ecological succession to a point of growing a carrot instead of just, you know, Bermuda grass. By the same token, a landscape, any kind of ecology is benefited by periodic disturbance factors, because that freshens it up, or I call it ecological exercise. It actually builds muscles. It actually makes it more efficient at converting solar energy into decomposable biomass than that ecology would do in a static state.
But how are we going to start adopting these farming methods, which are tried and true, and maybe old time, compared to some of this factory farming that we have now that claims it can feed so many people?
Well, first of all, this kind of farming that I'm discussing is certainly not anti-technology. I just described, you know, we use all this cool stuff, front-end loaders to build compost and chippers and shredders and electric fencing and portable hoop houses and skids and, you know, pneumatic tires and all sorts of cool techno-glitzy stuff. But it's all used in a way that honors and preserves the inherent, you know, the pigness of the pig, the cowness of the cow, the tomatoness of the tomato, and honors food as primarily a biological thing as opposed to a mechanical thing. In our culture, we collectively, the USDA, if you will, views agriculture and food production as primarily a mechanical function rather than a biological function. And I know if you're having Jeffrey Smith on in the next hour, that will really come to light as he addresses the difference between, you know, between looking at cells and life, between a mechanical function and a biological function.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, so on our farm, what we're using is high-tech infrastructure to allow us to enhance the natural pattern or template that we see in nature and enhance it beyond what it would do without the addition of human cleverness into it. Like being able to move the cows every single day to a fresh spot instead of being chased by wolves. We're moving them systematically with electric fencing. We can actually do better than nature could, you know, with wolves, fire, and Native Americans.
You know, I've interviewed local farmers on this program who talk about some of the issues they face, like sprawl, when they build a McMansion next to their property after some farmer has finally given up and sold out because it's just too tough for him and his family to make it, and they say people complain. You know, it's 4:30. What do you have to make all that noise? What's that smell? And I just don't know how small family farmers survive. How did your family address that?
Well, first of all, our farm is aesthetically and aromatically, sensually romantic. In other words, look. If you've got to walk through sheep dip and put on a hazmat suit to go visit your farmer, that might be food you don't want to eat. And the fact is that there are good ways to farm and there are bad ways to farm. And there are good ways to handle the landscape, bad ways to handle the landscape. And so, my farmer people that I would consider bad farmers, you know, just vilify me for even thinking to say such a phrase, but I think it has to be said. And so if you have a farm that doesn't smell, that smells wonderful, that is attractive, you know, who wants to go visit a confinement hog operation or a confinement poultry operation or a square mile of tomatoes that's being sprayed every other day with herbicides and pesticides? Those are not human-friendly places to be.
And that stuff has to wash off somewhere, like the Chesapeake Bay watershed or something like that. And then who knows what it does to the seafood you were talking about earlier. I have to take this break. We'll come back in just a second with more from Joel Satterlin of Polyface Farms. We also want to remind you that you can join the conversation right here and right now by dialing 1-866-391-1020 if you want to talk about food, what we eat, and where it comes from. KDK Radio News Time 432. Our number here is 1-866-391-1020. You can send us a message at the Dollar Bank Instant Access Center at our website, kdkradio.com. Joel Satterlin is our guest as we continue to talk to him about his farming operation, Polyface Farms. Joel, America, with just a three-day food supply, can we get used to eating local foods? I find when I go to farmers market, it seems like the food tastes a whole lot better.
Absolutely. That's the place to go. Of course, you know, there are community-supported agriculture. There are buying club out. There are all sorts of alternative marketing schemes out there. And there's no question. I mean, in this new book that I've just come out with, Folks, This Ain't Normal, I actually have a chapter in there with empirical studies showing, you know, the difference nutritionally in this food, and it blows your mind. I mean, like take pastured eggs. The USDA label, you know, for pastured eggs is 47 micrograms of folic acid per egg. Ours are 1,037. It doesn't even look like the same product. The fats are different. The polyunsaturates are different. I mean, everything is different. And so, so freshness, local transparency is the way to create integrity in the food supply because of the accountability and the short chain of custody between field and fork.
I think a lot of people, if they could go with me down to my home where I was born and raised and my wife is from, and go by some of these chicken houses where they process these birds, and it seems like they only take 6 weeks to grow to slaughter size. It just amazes me what they do with these chickens from, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg. I think a lot of people would almost stop eating chicken in America if they could see some of these operations. I wonder what you think of these mass operations.
Well, yeah, they grow them too fast, and they deny them the fundamental things that a bird. I mean, a chicken is a bird, right? Can we agree?
And it's in a cage where it can't move.
A chicken is a bird, and so if we're going to allow the chicken to express its chickenness, that chicken needs to have fresh air, sunshine. Those are both excluded from these big poultry houses. Certainly, no sun. And air is just, you know, fanned and pumped in. It's all fecal particulate air. They can't scratch anywhere. They can't. In fact, they cut their beak off so they don't kill each other because there's nothing for them to do. So they're bored, and they can't get a bug. They can't get a worm. They can't get a blade of grass. We know that salad is key to is one of our keys of maintaining correct vitamin mineral profiles in our own bodies. Well, it's the same thing in animals. That salad mix is extremely important, and so there's no comparison either nutritionally, taste, texture between an animal that's pastured and one that's in a confinement house. Now, while somebody would argue, but look how efficient those confinement houses are. Look how many animal. Look how much food's being raised in a single acre or whatever. The thing is, what you don't see are all the acres of grain being grown to be imported into that house, and all the acres taking the manure that house generates. So the industry wants you to think that those houses are some sort of an island, some sort of a standalone entity that's extremely efficient. The fact is that radiating out from that house are square miles of land that are creating the sea on which that house floats, and ultimately that sea is floating on oil, because the oil is what's growing the grain, transporting the grain, you know, powering the house with all the fans and the power and all that, and then ultimately, you know, taking the manure back out in, onto the field somewhere.
Not to mention the greenhouse gases that the manure and all the rest is causing, right?
Well, yeah, and so in our system, we don't use any more or less land. It's just that the birds are already on, they're out on pasture, so there's no, you know, there's no house, there's no energy, there's no fans, there's no concrete.
Well, what about predators, or do they just walk off or fly off or anything?
We have a guard dog. We have guard geese. Again, there are some amazing, you know, amazing technologies out here, mixing old and new. And you can take a dog with a, you know, with a Cabela's buzz collar, and you can train a dog amazingly from a distance to do wonderful things. We have a couple of Akbash Anatolian Shepherd crosses that can run 37 miles an hour, and they keep coyotes and bears, and they eat skunks and raccoons and possums and things like that, and they provide a perimeter of protection. So. Yeah, all of these things have an answer, and the beauty of this is that nobody has to lose here. You know, it all helps the landscape and helps the nutrition, helps the customer, helps the eater. I mean, everybody wins.
What role does government regulation play in restricting what you do as a farmer? I think of my cousin who gave us both strawberry and pear preserves, but if she were making those in her kitchen and trying to sell them, she gave them to us, and it's our cousin, so we willingly accept them. But what would happen to her if she was selling that stuff out of her kitchen?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, in this book that's just come out, Folks, This Ain't Normal, the last three or four chapters are about the abnormality of a culture in which we have an entire food police bureaucracy that that says it's perfectly safe to eat, you know, to feed your kids Mountain Dew, Cocoa Puffs, and Twinkies, but you know, that raw milk, compost-grown tomatoes, and Aunt Matilda's homemade pickles, you know, those are hazardous substances. And so we are the first culture that has gotten in between your lips and your throat to define for you what is acceptable and unacceptable food. Now, the problem is that the protocol, that the paradigm that the government is operating in as to what's good and what's not what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, or safe and not safe, is a paradigm that is completely anti-nutritional. And so you have these very, very strange anomalies. You know, when somebody hears me say something about raw milk, for example, you know, they go ballistic. You know, didn't people used to die from raw milk? Yeah, they did for a period of time during the early urbanization and factoryization of farms, when there was, you know, when the culture was moving more rapidly than our understanding of hygiene and our infrastructure development of stainless steel and refrigeration and rural electrification was able to keep up with the hygienic requirements of milk. Now we have all that. I mean, in Denmark, you can go and you can put a nickel in a machine. It'll give you raw milk out of the machine. You put a quarter in, it gives you a little more. You put a dollar in, it gives you a little more. And they've got dispensaries, you know, all over the country where you can just get raw milk on demand because it is so much more nutritious and better for you. It's it doesn't create the allergens. It doesn't create the asthma. It's a wonderful healing food. In fact, the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic actually started as an alternative to the filthy industrial urban confinement dairy operations of the early 1900s, and realized that real, true health beneficial raw milk came from a grass-based cow, a cow that was fed like an herbivore, not like a pig or a chicken, an omnivore. And so that's how the Mayo Clinic actually started healing people, was going back to a pasture-based herbivore situation with, you know, with raw dairy.
Wow. All right. Your book is available now. Your latest book is available now. Folks, this ain't normal. Where? Better bookstores online?
Anywhere, from Amazon to your local bookstore. It's available everywhere. It's even in the airport bookstores. It's everywhere.
And what about your website? Do people order from you in Virginia, where your farm is, different items?
Well, yeah, we have a gift shop. Our website is Polyface Farms. That's P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E, polyfacefarms.com. You can just Google it, Polyface, and it'll pop right up. And we've got a gift shop, and, you know, if you want to see where I'm speaking, it's got my schedule on there. It's got a lot of stuff about the farm and links to other things. This whole food police issue has gotten so bad that we now have a national organization called the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which people can join. It's like an NRA, but instead of being for guns, it's for food. And you know, I think it's pretty amazing that we have the freedom to worship and to speak and to assemble and to have guns, but we don't have the freedom to choose the food that we want to feed our 3 trillion member internal community of beings that gives us the fuel to go shoot, pray, and preach.
All right. Joel Salatin is our guest. Polyface Farms is his farm, a farm of many faces. We're going to continue our conversation with him, and you can join those who are on the phone right now. Hold on. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Our number is 1-866-391-1020. You can also send us comments at our website, kdkaradio.com, by going to the Dollar Bank Instant Access Center. We'll be right back and take your phone calls next. KDK Radio News Time, 4:45. Joel Salatin is our guest, and we continue to talk to him about Polyface Farms. Give us the website one more time.
Polyfacefarms.com, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E, farms.com.
All right, you ready to take some phone calls?
Yes, sir.
Let's do it. We'll go to Bloomfield. Kurt, hello. You're on KDK with Joel Salatin.
Good afternoon, Chris and Joel. I was thinking about the high fructose corn syrup. How is it responsible for our obesity epidemic in this country and all these processed foods or junk foods? How do they contribute to our health problems, or are we having an increase in health problems like cancer and diabetes because of these additives and these processed foods?
Well, I think the link between high fructose corn syrup and type 2 diabetes is pretty well established, unless you want to talk to the high fructose corn syrup lobby.
Well, they're putting out all the commercials saying sugar is sugar now.
Sugar is sugar. Well, you know, I got news for them. It's not. Just like we know that a tomato isn't a tomato, try a tomato out of your backyard and then take a tomato that's been shipped across the country and gassed from the San Joaquin Valley, and you'll find out real quick that there's a big difference.
No doubt.
What's amazing is that we're making it very easy in this country to eat junk, and making it difficult to eat stuff that's really good for you. So yeah, those are fascinating realities.
I know all this organic and natural food that's so expensive, and most people have in some of these poor neighborhoods are the junk food or the processed food.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that the junk food is less expensive is because it's worth less. We regard, you know, quality in price in boom boxes and clothes and vacations and entertainment and all sorts of things, but somehow, you know, our food is supposed to be dirt cheap and still, you know, really be good for us. And there's no free lunch. You either have to, you know, you either pay now or you pay later in medical bills, and so I just as soon pay now if you want to know the truth.
All right, let's go to East Liberty and Carlana. Carlana, you're on KDKA with Joel Salatin.
Yes, well, Dr. Vandana Shiva was here this past week, and when someone asked her, you know, what should we do, because she was telling about all the terrible things that Monsanto was doing and everything, and she said the most important thing that everybody can do at the local level is buy their food from local organic farmers, period. That's it. The most important effective thing you can do. And so I just thought I'd give you some places around here, which is, number one, the East End Food Co-op, which is near the corner of Penn and Braddock. And it's a grocery store and a little restaurant, and they get all their food from the local organic farmers. And then the slow food movement, there's the Slow Food International and Slow Food USA. There's a slowfoodpgh.com right here in town. And Penn State has is connected in some way with something called Yum Pittsburgh. That's Y-U-M, the word Pittsburgh, altogether, .com. And there's a whole bunch of other ones, which I won't go through. But the point is,
yes,
people can start doing it right now. And there's lots of organizations, too, set up with this community-supported agriculture where people, it's sort of like a co-op with a local farm.
Yeah, you basically invest in the production of a farm, and you get a share of that farm's production because you invested in it.
Right.
Boy, thank you for the call. You're exactly right. You know, the beauty of this, the beauty of what you're describing and what I'm promoting, of course, as part of being normal, is that we can change this foodscape and the agriculture scape. It doesn't take an act of Congress. It doesn't take, you know, a bailout plan. It doesn't take an agency, an organization. All it takes is for every person to start patronizing the venue that actually creates food integrity. And that'll be different things for different people. But the point is to actually make that conscious thought and vote with your food dollar, vote with it. You can vote with it multiple times a day, and I'm not saying you can never have a soda or never have a Snickers bar, but I am saying that at the end of the week, when you look back, we should be able to say which one of these two dogs did we feed. You know, the old proverb about the which dog, you know, grows bigger. Well, the one you feed. And so if we make that a conscious thought and realize that we're healing the landscape one bite at a time, absolutely, we will completely change the foodscape with the cumulative effect of lots of people doing the right thing.
You also urge people to grow something.
Yes, I do.
Anything.
I do. I mean, I realize there might be people that can't grow anything, but almost everybody can grow something, even if it's a patio pot or two chickens in your condominium. You know, get rid of the parakeets, put in some chickens. You know, they're far less noisy and far more productive, and they'll eat all your kitchen scraps, and then you don't have to take them down to put them into the biomass bin to go on a diesel truck to a composting facility and be re-imported as rose food compost. The real green thing, again, historically was that kitchen scraps didn't travel to composting sites. They got recycled with pigs or chickens, and I don't advise you to have a pig in your condominium, but certainly a couple chickens would be fine, and they certainly don't take up any more room than an aquarium.
You know, here in Pittsburgh, as a matter of fact, they've recently passed laws where if you live inside the city limits, you can raise a limited amount of chickens.
Yes. In fact, many, many municipalities are now doing this. It's part of what I call the local food or integrity food tsunami. And there have been, just in the last 2 years, I think about 6 book titles that I know of that are all about backyard chickens or urban chickens, or one of them's by Pat Forman called City Chicks.
I guess you got to have a sense of humor with this too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's food is fun. I mean, food's not drudgery. Food's fun. We need to. I would just add to Vandana Shiva's thing about buying from your local farmer. Know where your kitchen is to rediscover the joy and fun of domestic culinary arts. And we're a culture that's never spent more money remodeling and gadgetizing our kitchens and then more lost as to where they are.
I have a friend in Washington, D.C. He's single. It says whenever he meets a new female friend, they want to know what his GS number is. And not only do they, and he's a Southern kind of guy from Alabama, too.
Uh-huh.
He says not only do they want you to buy the microwave dinner, but they want you to put it in the oven, too. Now, I don't know if that's sexist or anything, but he tells me those are the kind of modern women he meets that don't know their way to the kitchen. But one thing my mother made sure of was that I knew my way around the kitchen, and my wife and I cook a lot now. But let me later today, we're going to talk to somebody from the Occupy Pittsburgh movement, and you write about grassroots movements and where they start. And so when we talk about the food we eat, where is our grassroots movement going to start and where is it going to go in the next minute and a half that we have with you?
Yeah, well, I think it's already started. It started by the very kinds of things that this caller from East Liberty just mentioned, with CSAs and the slow food and Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund and all this, you know, this kind of societal infrastructure built around this entire movement. But beyond that, we have to understand that if it's going to be, it's up to me, and the future that we envision is a cumulative effect of all the little activities that you and I do. And so when you get in your kitchen and cook from scratch unprocessed food acquired locally, that creates demand and patronage for a different kind of food system. And when you do that times 100, times 1,000 people, suddenly you completely change the foodscape into one that's integrity and accountable and nutrient dense and actually keeps you out of the hospital instead of putting you into it.
And the book, folks, This Ain't Normal, it's available now?
Yes, sir, it's available now. It came out 3 weeks ago, and it's available anywhere that you like to buy books. Folks, This Ain't Normal.
And your website, one more time?
Polyfacefarms.com.
And if there's one word of advice you'd like to leave, especially all of us urbanites, what would it be about the food that we eat?
It can be positive or negative, and it's up to you to find out what's positive and patronize it.
All right, Joe, we really appreciate you coming on the program here at KDK. I hope we can talk to you again sometime in the near future, okay?
Thank you, Chris. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
All right, you take care of yourself.
Yes, sir, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, I'm Chris Moore, and later in the program, we'll talk to people from the Occupy Pittsburgh movement. We are also going to talk in the next hour to Jeffrey Smith, who's the author of the number one GMO bestseller, Seeds of Deception and Genetic Roulette. Well, he'll talk about some shocking evidence why genetically modified crops may lead to health and environmental catastrophes and what we can do about it. We're talking about food, glorious food, on this edition of our program here at KDKA. Our number is 1-866-391-1020. That's 1-866-391-1020. And, of course, as we talk about food, if you want to talk about it and your mouth is full, you can always write down what you want to say and send it along at the Dollar Bank Instant Access Center. Just go to our website at kdkaradio.com and send us your thoughts. All right, we're going to take this commercial break, and then we shall return. The news is next on KDK after these announcements.